Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 33rd podcast. My name is John Zagluo, owner and operator of the site. We have a lot to get to today, covering all of Chicago's sports teams, plus, later in the show, a very special guest granting me an exclusive interview. It will be a very compelling conversation, so I encourage you to stay tuned on this podcast and wait till the interview later in the show. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram and LinkedIn at John Zags and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the local area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Mucci World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park. If you have any questions, give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. To start off today, we'll talk about the Bears and recap the players they drafted in this year's 2018 NFL Draft. Now, before the draft, we had a draft preview show with Kirk Morrison, former NFL linebacker and current analyst for SiriusXM NFL Radio, and he told me that the Bears were going to be looking possibly for either a wide receiver or a linebacker. Luckily enough, the Bears ended up selecting Roquan Smith, linebacker from Georgia, with their 8th overall pick. Now, in that same podcast, I expressed some doubt about Smith, and I'll recap it just a moment here. Here's the problem I see with Smith. Now, a couple years back, we all remember when the Bears drafted Leonard Floyd. Linebacker from Georgia, had an outstanding senior year at Georgia, and right now with the Bears has, let's say, underperformed in some respects. I mean, the expectations for him were so high, and as of right now, I don't think he's lived up to them, or at least could be living up to them. Looking at Smith here, linebacker from Georgia, a great senior year. Those are eerily similar to Floyd. And then, of course, the Bears picking him in the first round in the top 10. So too many similarities for me had me a bit skeptical and a bit worried about Roquan Smith, and that's not just my opinion. I read a column via the Chicago Tribune website by Steve Rosenblum, and here's the headline for you. We could be looking at a new era of new embarrassments from Bears draft picks with Roquan Smith front and center. So again, it's not only me who's a bit concerned about this choice. I feel like there were better players on the board for the Bears to select rather than Roquan Smith. And as I mentioned, with those similarities to Leonard Floyd, I am worried about his potential production in the NFL. Ironically enough, after Smith, the Bears ended up drafting better, in my opinion, grabbing with their second round pick, James Daniels from Iowa. Daniels is a center. And right now, it's looking as if he might start over Cody Whitehair, actually, because the Bears want to move Whitehair to a spot on the offensive line in one of the interior three positions. So, maybe the Bears didn't get who I wanted in Quentin Nelson, but they ended up getting somebody to bolster that offensive line. And technically, Daniels is close to a Nelson, because you still have a powerful offensive line now with Whitehair, Long, and now Daniels. So it's not like the Bears lost out in any respect, but of course, you know, Nelson is a consensus first-round pick, a consensus possible Hall of Famer in many people's eyes, but I feel like Daniels will get the job done and could turn some heads here coming up during the season. And also, Anthony Miller, second-round pick number 19 from Memphis. I am very happy with this selection. The Bears needed a wide receiver. They lost Cameron Meredith to the Saints via a restricted free agency deal. They weren't willing to pay him the money. And Kevin White, simply put, is a complete and utter bust. He's played 5 games after being drafted in the first round in 2015. That is an embarrassment. So getting a wide receiver was a priority for the Bears, and they did it by getting Anthony Miller. Miller, collegiately, was a very good player and the number one wide receiver for the Memphis Tigers. Despite redshirting his freshman year as a junior and senior, he had over 1,400 receiving yards, over 95 receptions, while averaging 15 yards per catch. That is just out of this world in regards to stats. This guy is a proven deep threat, as evidenced by his 15 yards per catch. He was a number one wide receiver with Memphis, and I think he has the potential to do it here in Chicago. I mean, what real competition does he have besides Allen Robinson? Taylor Gabriel is an established number two to number three, and behind him it looks murky at best. Look for Miller to make some strides in training camp and possibly get the one or two start come game one for the Bears this year. And when reflecting on all of the moves that the Bears have made, of course, in the draft and in free agency, there is one conclusion that I can come to. Mitchell Trubisky has no more excuses, and that's the truth. The Bears have bolstered the offensive line, gotten new receivers via the draft and via free agency, so now it's all on Mitch, because he has the right pieces and the right weapons to make him successful. So this year will truly prove whether he is fit for the NFL or not, in my opinion. Because you could argue that last year, sure, he didn't have the receivers, or he didn't have a good team, a good coordinator, whatever you want to say. But this year, there is no reason for failure for Mitchell Trubisky. If he doesn't throw for 3,500 yards and at least 15 touchdowns, I am going to be disappointed in him. In other Bears news, we have rookie minicamp beginning today through the end of this weekend. And next week, OTAs begin. Very exciting time seeing everybody reconvene after the offseason and getting ready for what's ahead. The Hall of Fame game, by the way, on August 2nd and September 9th or 10th is week one of the NFL season. So it's really right around the corner. I mean, the Super Bowl feels like only a couple of weeks ago, but right away, we're getting back at it and getting ready for Bears football. Shifting to hoops, let's talk about some Chicago Bulls news. Lots of interesting things going on in regards to the NBA draft. Right now, the Bulls are looking at likely to be the number 6 pick in this draft. Some odds were just posted by ESPN a few hours ago in regards to odds for the first round pick and odds for being in the top 10. Right now, the Bulls are at likely spot number 6. Their odds to get the number 1 pick are 5.3%, so let's put it this way, we all knew that in general that the Bulls were not going to get that pick. Their top 3 pick odds are 18.3%. According to ESPN, if they land in the top 3, they should pick DeAndre Ayton, Jaren Jackson Jr., or the foreigner, Luka Doncic. But the most likely pick will be Wendell Carter Jr., the center from Duke. And I find this a bit humorous because last time we had talked about draft picks and touched on who the Bulls may or may not select, I know ESPN and some other media outlets had said, no, it's going to be Trae Young without a doubt with the possibility of Michael Porter Jr. Now it's looking like Wendell Carter Jr. will be coming to the Bulls. Let's talk more about him. So, with Duke this year, his only season, 13.5 points per game and 9.1 boards. A very big presence under the rim. And he's 6'10", 259. So, a bigger guy, someone the Bulls could use considering that Robin Lopez is on his way out. Lopez this year, underproductive, getting older. The Bulls could use someone like Carter to complement Markkanen and have a very good combo under the rim. I mean, we could see them being compared to like an Anthony Davis or DeMarcus Cousins at some point. Both guys have the potential to be superstars in the NBA. And we saw that for Markkanen this year, averaging 15-8. And Carter could be a very good complementary piece to Markkanen and to the team itself. Now, according to KC Johnson, who is the Chicago Bulls beat reporter for the Chicago Tribune, the Bulls should not even go near Trae Young or Michael Porter Jr. Actually, he's compiled a list of, let's say the Bulls got number one or number two, who they should pick. If the Bulls somehow get number one, they're going to draft DeAndre Ayton, a center from Arizona, 7'1", 250. If they get number two, it'll be Marvin Bagley III. Number three, Jaren Jackson Jr. And now he says for number 6 or 7, Mikal Bridges from Villanova. So that's contrasting what ESPN has said, but once we get down to 8, he says Wendell Carter Jr. as well. So some similarities, some differences between Johnson and ESPN, but it's looking like right now either Wendell Carter Jr. or Mikal Bridges will come to the Bulls via the draft. Because, unfortunately, the Bulls will not be getting picks 1 through 3, and if they do, it'll be a miracle. Their odds are very low, but if they do get up there, I would love to see Marvin Bagley or Jackson come to this team, because that would be even more beneficial than the guys we're talking about now. But remember, the Bulls don't have to get everyone they need in the draft. Free agency is coming up, and we have an article here that will talk about some players in which the Bulls could grab. Now, obviously, the team is not going to be engaged so much in free agency because they're still in the middle of a rebuild. But there are some players out there who the Bulls could grab who can help mentor the youth and also provide some quality play. The first is Trevor Ariza, right now of the Rockets. He's an unrestricted free agent, so once the playoffs end, he's free to go wherever. This past season, 12 points, 4 boards, 1.5 steals, while shooting 37% from 3. Now, I'm a bit biased in my argument because I love Trevor Ariza. I remember him playing with the New Orleans Hornets with Chris Paul and J.R. Smith, and that was an electric team. Ariza's only 32 years old and still has some basketball left in him. He could come on this team, help mentor the youngsters while getting some playing time and starting at the small forward position for the Bulls. That's someone that the team needs after a rotation this year. Now, secondly, we're looking at Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. This season, 13 points, 5 boards, 1.4 steals. Now, Pope is much younger, but my problem with him is his disciplinary issues. This year, with the Lakers, he had to serve time in a halfway house and actually miss certain practices and games that were outside of the LA area because he wasn't allowed to travel. So will that be a problem if he comes to the Bulls? I think it might be, and that's my only problem with Pope. He's not that bad of a player, and in fact, has a lot of talent for a guy who's still relatively young. But with that troubled past, I would have problems trusting him while simply worrying about the fact that he may not even be able to travel on the road with his team. So that's something that would be detrimental to this young Bulls team trying to rebuild, trying to learn the ropes of the NBA. That would only be a negative influence, so I don't think Caldwell Pope is the right move for Chicago. The final player in this list is Avery Bradley, another unrestricted free agent, and this past year averaged 15 points, 2 assists, and 1 steal. You may remember Bradley from 2 years ago when the Bulls and the Celtics played in the first round of the playoffs. He went off from behind the arc and really, single-handedly almost, got rid of the Bulls and their playoff chances. This past season, in split time with the Detroit Pistons and the LA Clippers, Bradley did okay. He's only 27 years old. He would be a fantastic add for the Bulls. He can help out supplement LaVine, move LaVine over possibly to the small forward position, have Bradley start at shooting guard. And one thing that I really like about Bradley is that he can provide you with some quality play without breaking the bank. Everyone knows who Avery Bradley is, yet for some reason, he's not getting this very outrageous contract. He's getting something that proves his worth. And I think Bradley coming to the Bulls, averaging 15-2, that's not bad for a team trying to rebuild. So look for the Bulls to target Bradley as well this coming offseason. Moving to the diamond, let's check in on the Chicago Cubs and find out how they've been doing. Right now, they are 19-15, 1.5 games behind the NL Central Division leading St. Louis Cardinals. And that division itself is looking like to be very competitive, like in years past, as St. Louis, Milwaukee, and Pittsburgh are all in front of the Cubs, even though the Cubs are only 1.5 games out of first place. So very bunched up right now. Then again, though, you're only 35, 36 games into the year. I'm sure by season's end, things will change in that division. But looking at some standout players right now, Javier Baez leading the team in homers, RBIs, stolen bases, runs scored, slugging, and overall hits. He is having just a monstrous year. And speaking candidly here, I never would have imagined Baez to produce at this high of a level. I mean, last year in his role, semi on the field, semi on the bench, he had, what, 24 homers? He did good. I never thought, though, that he'd be able to turn it all around, and now he's hitting like a superstar. I mean, 287, OPS a 964. I would have never expected that out of Baez. He is curbing down the strikeouts. He's being a little more patient, as demonstrated by his heightened on-base percentage. It's the highest of his career at this point. So he is having a great year. And if it wasn't for his performance, I think the Cubs could be under 500 right now. Because guys like Rizzo and Bryant, although waking up right now, weren't waking up come the beginning of the season. And speaking of some interesting things, take a look at Addison Russell's stat line when you get a chance, because it is starting to make me wonder about him. He's hitting 261, which is something that I am happy for. I have been advocating since day one about Addison Russell that my problem with him is that he is horrible at hitting for average. I mean, his career batting average is still 241, and to this day, despite this good period right now, I kind of consider him a bust, because back in the minor leagues, this guy was hitting 300, he was a stud hitter, but since he's come to the majors, although he has provided excellent defense, he has done nothing at the plate. So he's hitting 261 right now in 111 at-bats. That's pretty good. But one homer, 8 RBIs, and 1 stolen base. So this is really interesting, because in years past, Russell has kind of been on the verge of being a power hitter. 2 years ago, 21 homers, 95 RBIs at the shortstop position. Those RBI and home run totals for the shortstop position are above average. He was considered a okay to good hitter at that time, and now hitting more for average but less for power. I like that philosophy, and I feel like it's working very well for him. And I'll tell you one thing, if he can maintain this and hit around 260 to 270 by the end of the year, I will have to rethink my opinion on Addison Russell. Because that is good. That is something that I can expect from him, hitting 260 or 270. Better than 240 or heck, even 235. But what's really interesting about this Addison Russell story is the fact that he's doing well and that he's on the trade block right now in a possible trade for Manny Machado. According to some rumors out there, it's looking like the Cubs are hypothetically going to offer Addison Russell, Ian Happ, or Kyle Schwarber. And although that sounds like a lot of players, keep in mind that these are certain players. Some of them could be just a Happ and Schwarber combo for Machado, others a Russell and Happ combo. So all those three players have been mentioned in rumors, but that doesn't necessarily mean all three will be traded at once just for one player. But anyways, Machado is a bona fide superstar, one of the best players in Major League Baseball. Now, the problem with getting Machado is that he'd be a rental, similar to the Aroldis Chapman trade. And by the way, Gleyber Torres, the guy the Cubs gave up, recently hit a walk-off homer for the Yankees and is succeeding right now at the Major League level. So, although the Cubs did win a World Series with Chapman, right now, look who's winning that trade. It looks like the Yankees. But anyways, let me throw a hypothetical situation your way. Let's say the Cubs get Machado, and he helps them go all the way to the World Series in which they win it again. You're going to tell me Machado is just going to be that easygoing about the situation? You're going to tell me that, you know what, he's going to leave right away no matter what? I don't think so. And I think that if he has a good experience here in Chicago, winning a ring and being a part of a team like this, I think he might consider staying. And if that's the case, that will be an immense steal for the Cubs. Now, of course, if he leaves, so what? But you have to consider all angles here. You can't just assume that after this year, Machado is leaving no matter what, whether the Cubs win it all or not. Think about the positives. Think about Machado possibly staying. If the Cubs could find a way to pay him and keep him happy, I feel like he could be a valuable addition to this team, and it would be a steal in regards to the trade. Moving to the south side, let's take a look at the Chicago White Sox and see how they've been doing. Right now, it's been a dismal year, to say the least. Currently 9-25, the worst record and winning percentage in baseball at .265. They're 1-9 in their last 10 games. Offensively speaking, the team has a couple of bright spots. Matt Davidson with 9 homers and 19 RBIs, and also Yoimer Sanchez hitting .302 and leading the team in batting average. But other than that, it's been a tough year for the team. Yoan Moncada, a guy I profiled in my last article, is currently hitting .263 with 6 home runs. Not bad, but consider this. This guy was supposed to be a top prospect. This was a guy the Sox gave up Chris Sale for crying out loud. I think he needs to be doing better because he is not living up to his expectations. As far as on the mound goes, right now, the one player who has really been doing well for this team is Reynaldo Lopez. Currently, Lopez is actually placing as one of the league leaders in ERA despite having no wins. Has a 2.44 ERA in 44 and a third innings, 7 starts, but he's 0-2 with his record. Obviously, a lack of run support considering that ERA, but this reminds me, and I think I mentioned this before, about Jeff Samardzija when he was here with the Cubs during their rebuild. Samardzija made the All-Star team despite going 2-7 with an ERA of 2.99. I mean, so looking at Lopez here, very comparable. Obviously a good pitcher considering that ERA, but his record doesn't show for it. Ironically enough, when looking at Lopez and comparing him to the other pitchers on this team, he leads the team in ERA, strikeouts, whip, batting average against, and innings pitched. He doesn't even have one yet. In regards to other starting pitchers on this team, it's not looking that good. Lucas Giolito in ERA over 7, James Shields did lower his ERA to just above 5, and Carson Fulmer, although he leads the team with 2 wins, has an ERA just over 5. So the starting rotation experiencing some troubles, which is not good considering that Fulmer and Giolito are 2 prospects in which the White Sox have trusted and are counting on to perform. It's unfortunate for the team. And I know there are some people out there who are not happy with the way in which I portrayed the Sox. They're not happy in my coverage of the team. Well, let me say this. The Sox right now have not won 10 games yet, and we're in the second week of May. Furthermore, they have prospects whom they have been hoping on who are not performing at the major league level. You tell me what the problem is there. When Chris Bryant came up with the Cubs, immediately he delivered. Yet when Yoan Moncada on the White Sox became a part of the team, he did nothing. And this year, in his first full season with the team, he really hasn't done much. He hasn't made a big enough impact to help them out. And speaking of their pitchers, like Fulmer and Giolito, those two guys are also top picks who have not necessarily been doing well this year. So sure, I may be a bit critical of the team, but that's because they have guys who they are putting their hopes and dreams on who are not performing in the way that they should be. And finally, before we get to our special guest, let's talk about some Chicago Blackhawks news. Right now, as of yesterday, the Hawks will be receiving the number 27 pick in the 2018 NHL Draft from the Predators. After the Hawks traded Ryan Hartman back in February, they received some sort of compensation to be named later. Well, it turns out it'll be the 27 overall pick. They will also have a 4th-round pick from the team. That means that in this year's draft, the Hawks have 8 picks, including 2 in the 1st round, 3rd round, and 4th round. So, an opportunity here for the team to draft some upstart players to help them out after this past season. And for reference, the Hawks have the number 8 overall pick in this year's NHL draft. Lots of young talent in those top 10 positions that will be off the board, including Noah Dobson, an 18-year-old Canadian defenseman playing in the QMJHL. Dobson is one of the best players in this draft, and the Hawks have a chance to get him at number 8. Also, Quinn Hughes is another player to look for. Hughes is an 18-year-old American defenseman currently playing for the University of Michigan. He is a skilled puck mover, but is only 5'10" compared to Dobson at 6'3". Nevertheless, he's considered an exciting playmaker and somebody to look for come draft night for the Hawks. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He was selected first overall in the 2001 NFL Draft by the Atlanta Falcons. By 2002, he became the team's starting quarterback, leading Atlanta to a playoff appearance while making the Pro Bowl. In 2006, he set the single-season record for most rushing yards by a quarterback at 1,039. He then went to Philadelphia, making another Pro Bowl appearance while leading the team to 2 playoff appearances in 5 years. Today, he is a football analyst on FS1, as well as the offensive coordinator of the Alliance of American Football franchise in Atlanta. Please welcome Michael Vick to the show. Michael, how are you doing today? Thanks for being on the show. It's quite an honor to have you here.
Hey, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Doing great, man. I'm so happy.
That was an awesome intro.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So, first off, I'd like to take a look back at your illustrious football career. I mean, the numbers you put up, you know, being a dual threat, being a runner and passer, were amazing. So, what was your secret to success? Because, you know, there are a lot of quarterbacks today who are frowned upon for being, you know, running quarterbacks, like Lamar Jackson, for example. But your career really serves as an exception to that rule. So, how'd you do it?
Well, I think it's a credit to my coaches. Dan Reeves, for example, he really put together game plans that allowed me to show my talent. And if it was running the football on quarterback draws, the design run quarterback draws that he put together, just quarterback rollouts with great blocking schemes, allowed me to be myself and let the talents that I had show. And I guess he looked at it as, why have a mobile quarterback and not use him? So he was able to go into his offensive playbook and tweak some things and put me in a position to help the team win. I was getting first downs, keeping chains moving, and helping the team win games week in and week out at an early age. So as well as, you know, Greg Knapp on numerous occasions, the year I ran 4,000 yards. And then when I got to Andy, Andy allowed me to use those talents as well.
You know, speaking of Andy Reid and your time with the Eagles, you know, I had to ask this question. I remember Monday Night Football, you were signed by the Eagles, you became the starting quarterback, and that infamous game against the Washington Redskins, you threw for 333 yards and 4 touchdowns. I think after that game, everyone was like, you know what, Michael Vick is back. What contributed to your success that night? And, you know, take me through what happened, because that was just an amazing game to watch, so electrifying and so entertaining.
It was just being motivated. I think, you know, before the game, Donovan McNabb had been awarded a big contract. And, you know, sometimes as competitors, you want to be, you know, along the lines of the greats in the same lineage. And, you know, I felt as if I was to go out that night and showcase my talents on the national stage, it would show that in years to come, I could be, you know, elite quarterback, premier quarterback in the league and get paid top dollar. Amongst the best. And just having that happen right before the game, maybe 3 hours before, really just fueled my fire. And when I went into the game, I was calm. Money wasn't on my mind. It was all about being successful on the field and making the guys around me better. And at the end of the day, winning the game.
So speaking of your career, I wanted to go back to the time in which you were drafted. You were drafted first overall by the Atlanta Falcons. So with that in mind, first, you know, what was it like to be drafted so high, being the number one selection? And also, what did it mean to you to be the first African-American quarterback to be drafted first overall?
Well, it was great. And, you know, just, you know, as far as, you know, my lack of knowledge in that situation, you know, I wasn't aware that I was going to be the first African-American quarterback selected. It wasn't until after it happened. Because you got to wait till things happen, and I was able to embrace that. And I know the draft is a tricky process, but that was a great accomplishment within its own right. And, you know, I felt like, you know, that opened doors and just paved the way for guys, you know, behind me and guys to come. And that night, it was a night I'll never forget. You know, you work your whole life, you know, to walk across that stage and meet the commissioner, shake his hand and turn and face the crowd and smile and you know, thank God that you've arrived. And, you know, it's just a real moment, and it's, you only get to live it one time. And I'm just glad I was a guy who can share those memories with people, you know, like you and people around the world who ask the same question and want some insight on it. It's an unbelievable experience. And, you know, for the young kids right now dreaming, you know, it's a great dream to dream, and it can be accomplished.
So you get drafted by Atlanta, and after your second year, you truly put yourself on the map, because at 24 years old, you were featured on the cover of Madden 2004. And I mean, your ascent was huge. In a period of 5 years, you went from collegiate superstar to really the face of the NFL. So what was that like for you, and how were you able to handle all of this newfound fame and cope with that?
Well, I've always been a humble kid, and, you know, my coach in college, Ricky Bussell, my offensive coordinator, always told me, you know, if I keep the humility on a level plane, then I'll always be able to see the world clearly. And, you know, through all my success and it happened fast, you know, it was the people there to help keep me grounded. And I wanted to stay that way throughout the course of my career and not become, you know, an arrogant person, just remain a confident person, you know, in my own right. And, you know, the fame, it all came, and when it came, it was abrupt and it was immense. And I didn't really want it. I knew I had to deal with it, and with responsibilities like that, you know, requires a lot of time. And, you know, I wanted to enjoy life and still enjoy the fame, so I had to find a balance. And it was difficult, but I had fun. And the thing I always went back to was just thanking God for allowed me to be the person who had that responsibility, and that's the way I was able to accept it.
So I wanted to go to 2007, and at the height of your career. Now, You pleaded guilty to federal charges involving a dogfighting investigation and served 18 months in prison. So what I wanted to ask you is, you know, what was that time like for you, and what life lessons did you learn, and how did you overcome that experience to come out strong and end up playing, you know, many more years in the NFL?
Yeah, a lot of that time was spent on just trying to figure out, you know, how to make amends and right my wrongs. And, you know, I think, you know, what it all initially starts with is forgiving yourself for being put in that situation, or putting yourself in that situation, and then having to suffer the consequences when you disappoint so many people. So I was able to forgive myself and let it go, and then, you know, figure out a plan moving forward within that 18-month time span. And, you know, to be able to think for that long, you almost have no choice but to come out and be successful, especially when you have people waiting for you at the finish line and ready to help you, you know, go about your life and move about it different. So those people was very influential. You know, we all know who they are, the Andy Reeves of the world, Coach Tony Dungy, Roger Goodell, those guys were there when I reached the finish line, you know, of my prison sentence, and they opened the doors for me and said, okay, here we go again. Here's an opportunity. You know, you will be viewed as one of the guys who had an opportunity to get a second chance. It's all about what you make it look like and what you do with it. And I accepted that responsibility, and still to this day, I accept that responsibility, because, you know, that will last a lifetime. I feel like I represent a lot of people, when I'm doing the things that I do.
So what did it mean to you, you know, to get that second chance? Because I'm sure there were times where you were wondering, you know, will I ever play in the NFL again? So getting that second opportunity via Coach Reed and Coach Dungy and Roger Goodell, what did that mean to you?
It meant so much. And still to this day, you know, Roger, you know, his lines of communication are open. Tony Dungy, line of communication is open. Andy, you know, just, you know, vouch for me to become a coach in, you know, the AAL. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, those guys, they never give up on you. And, you know, times may get tough and things might not be the best on the field, you know, similar to what me and Andy went through in 2012 and 11. But we didn't have the best seasons after having such a good 2010. And even when it's all over, you look back on it and you still appreciate those moments. And to this day, those guys leave an open line of communication for me, and I'm forever grateful.
I wanted to ask you about something that's been going on in the NFL today. It's been a cause of many headlines, and it has to do with Colin Kaepernick and the fact that he is still without a job simply because of kneeling during the national anthem. So, in your opinion, why is he still jobless, and do you agree with what he's doing and then what the NFL community is doing in retaliation?
You know, I think everyone has their own perspective of what's taking place. And, you know, if you look at it from afar, you kind of sit back and say, okay, I understand both sides of it. And when you look at it, you know, it's kind of hard to absorb and contain, because, you know, on so many levels, this happens in so many different workplaces. And, you know, people just take their own stand. But, you know, sometimes with that stand, you know, comes a lot of responsibility. And sometimes, it comes with, you know, certain consequences. And, you know, for whatever reason, people can sort those thoughts out, you know, all day and not come to a definite conclusion or answer. You know, I think, you know, for the duration, you know, in that case, you know, at some point, you know, things will be, you know, revealed and headlined as an opportunity for us to all move forward. And I think they'll get it right now. You know, with Kaepernick not playing now, you know, it's obvious there's other things going on. You know, within that, you know, situation, like the case or whatever it may be. So, you know, that may become a setback. But, you know, as long as he continues to train, I think, you know, when you have, you know, 20 to 25 smart people, you know, trying to make a decision on something, at the end of the day, they'll get it right. And I think the world just has to be patient, so in that case, it can be done right.
So I wanted to shift gears now to your life today. Now, you were recently named the offensive coordinator for the Alliance of American Football franchise in Atlanta. So how did this opportunity come about, and could we see you coaching possibly in the NFL someday as well?
You know, I had the internship with Coach Reed in Kansas City last year, which kind of turned me on to coaching. And, you know, who knows what can happen in the future. I think this opportunity to coach for Alliance Atlanta is really a great opportunity to just get my feet wet, you know, study under Coach Brad Childress, be the offensive coordinator, be the guy who communicate with the guys and set things up, you know, offensively, internally, and, you know, try to help guys understand the system that I know so well. So it'll be fun. You know, we're going to go out and try to find other guys who can contribute, guys who have experience in coaching or weather playing. And, you know, just embrace it, man. Embrace it, go out and compete and try to win. Ultimately, anything that I do, it's all about winning at the end of the day. And I, you know, thank, you know, Andy Reid, who, you know, gave me, you know, talked to some people who gave me an opportunity, who believed in me, all the people who, you know, are working, you know, tirelessly to make this league work, you know, the Charlie Ebersols and the J.K. McKay's, you know, so, you know, we're putting it all, they're putting it all together, you know, we're excited about it, and, you know, it's going to be a phenomenal league.
You know, you mentioned Andy Reid, you know, helping you out throughout this whole process. You know, I was wondering, because he was your coach back in Philadelphia during the times that were good and during the times that were bad as well, so how'd you guys keep that relationship strong even after you ended up leaving Philadelphia?
Like I said, Coach Reid never closed the door on our friendship, our you know, working relationship. You know, when he, you know, got fired from, you know, Philadelphia and hired the next day as Kansas City Chiefs head coach, I probably was one of the first guys to reach out to him and congratulate him. And you know, to this day, he's just one of the most genuine people that I've ever met in my life. And, you know, any guy who can put a smile on your face, you know, when you're crying tears, you know, is a special person, because everyone can't do that. And, you know, to certain people, I don't know if I can, you know, if I possess that quality or if I can do that. I guess it all depends on the situation. But Coach Reid is a guy, you know, with the sense of humor that he has. You know, find ways to just keep people happy, man, and make people feel comfortable.
So today you are also keeping busy by running a clothing brand called Michael Vick's V7 Clothing. So can you tell me more about this and how it all started?
Yeah, V7 Clothing is a hobby, man. I mean, initially it started MV7 with Nike in 2003 when they launched the V7 edition of my cleat line. And you know, we had 5 cleats that we produced, and then we followed it up with a clothing line, and I had big dreams, and, you know, not to do it on a broad scale, to do it just to keep the brand going and you know, keep V7 alive as far as the legacy. It's something that we still do. We've collaborated with certain retail stores, and, you know, the V7 Hokie edition will be online at Fanatics, and it's on at the bookstore on Virginia Tech campus right now, as we speak. So, 3 different locations. That collaboration with Virginia Tech was amazing. And, I think it was a big stepping stone. It's something that I don't think has ever been done, with the player who represented the school and the clothing line collaboration. So I think it's something that we've been able to do that's special with Virginia Tech. So we're just taking it slow, man, not trying to overdo it. Not trying to overhaul it, but make sure that, you know, we do it and it's clean and it's for the people.
You know, how special is that for you, too, to partner with your alma mater to, you know, do this? Because I know Virginia Tech for you, you know, was so special, your time there, and now you're coming back, you know, years later to partner with them. What does that mean to you?
Man, it means a lot. It goes to show that the people at the school still care. Now, I know with this commitment from them is going to come with a lot of stipulations, but the best part about it is that, you know, proceeds from the clothing line will be donated back to the school for scholarships and for various opportunities that the school has going for them right now. So, you know, it's not all about Michael Vick at the end of the day. It's all about giving back. And, you know, I think that collaboration allows me to give back to the school year in and year out. And, you know, for our fans to become a part of something that's special and what we've built together, they've always supported me over the years, you know, from Coach Beamer to Coach Fuente, from Jim Weaver to Whit Babcock. You know, those guys are, you know, still influential people for that program.
So, finally, I wanted to ask you about stepping away from the game after a memorable 13-year career. How did you feel after retiring from the game, and what was it like to see your career come to an end? Because, you know, lots of players, some at least, think, you know what, I'm never going to stop playing football. But, you know, that time comes, and how did you deal with it? How did it feel to be done with the game of football after such a great run and such a memorable run, too?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the thing that made it easier for me, it was such a great run. From my years in Atlanta to my years in Philadelphia, you know, having the opportunity to meet so many people and being able to connect with, you know, two different fan bases, then going to New York, connecting with that fan base. And by the time I got to Pittsburgh, you know, you do something for so long and, you know, it comes so easy. You know, it became a point where, you know, I wasn't, you know, as into it as I was when I was younger. And you feel that, and I think that's the way it's supposed to feel. You know, when you know you're ready to go, and by the time the season was over in Pittsburgh, it was more so me thinking about being with family, making up for all the lost time, and seeing what life would be like without the game of football. And those are the moments that I appreciate. The time leading up to the retirement, me being prepared and ready, helped me to continue to brand myself after football and say, hey, I'm not going to just stay away from the game. I'm going to stay connected. I want to talk about it. I want to still play it. You know, I still want to coach it. You know, I still want to support the guys who supported me for years. And, you know, that's just the way I looked at it. And you know, it's working out up until this point. And I love the game so much that that love will never die.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for being here on the show today. Great experience, and I'm so happy that you took the time to be here.
Hey, thanks for having me. Anytime.
What an honor it was to have Michael Vick here on today's show. I was talking to him off the air, and he was telling me, you know, he had a great time, he loved the questions, and he said he'd love to come on again down the road, and it was really awesome to have him here and talk so much about his life, you know, from his days in football, his time in prison, and what he learned, and then later on today, now with his clothing brand, and him being the new offensive coordinator of the Alliance of American Football franchise in Atlanta. So lots of things happening for him in his life today, and so happy to have him on and talk about them. Before we end today's show, it's time for our famed Announcer's Call of the Day segment. Now, with Michael Vick being on today, I thought, hey, why not play something that I remember clearly about his career, and that goes back to my question to him about that Monday night football game between the Eagles and Redskins. Here we are on the call with Mike Tirico. This is the first play of the game for the Eagles. Let's listen to what happens.
First play from about the 12, and there is Vic, as you talked about, John, rolling and launching downfield for DeSean Jackson, who accelerates, caught the opening play, and all the way for a touchdown! 88 yards!
What a job there by Michael Vick. Excellent call for Mike Tirico. And as Vick said, before that game, he heard about Donovan McNabb getting that big contract extension, and that motivated him to do well against the Redskins that night. Well, thank you all for listening to today's show. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ShyTalkSports. Hit me up personally on Instagram and LinkedIn at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. A special thank you one more time to Michael Vick for being on today's show. And finally, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can enter your email in a box on the homepage that will allow you to receive updates whenever anything new is posted, whether a new podcast or article. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.